Tim, thank you for your 6-minute presentation. You know, the reason I asked you to speak on what happens next is because I wanted to learn about the European political experience and then apply it to the United States. Now, you just published a new book called Riding the Populist Wave: Europeans' Mainstream Right in Crisis. And in that book, you explain which values and issues predict voter preferences. Can you please explain for me your political science framework that helps define the European right and left?
What we first go into is what is right and what is left. We say that the difference between the two is their attitudes to inequality. The left is very much opposed to the idea of inequality. The right accepts it as natural and productive for the economy. You have what we call the mainstream right, which we divide into market liberal parties and Christian democratic parties. And you have the far right, which can be divided into the extreme right, which sometimes flirts with violence, and the populist radical right. And we frame those in terms of what Ronald Inglehart, an American political scientist, called the silent revolution, which began really in the late 60s and 1970s and sees a gradual spread of liberal progressive values, post-material values throughout the population, and particularly the educated. And on the other hand, there's been a backlash against that, what the Italian political scientist Piero Ignazi calls the silent counter-revolution, which is really a kind of rejection of the values of the silent revolution. And it's very concerned with the cultural change, and in particular focuses on immigration.
Let me describe the framework as the Ronald Inglehart silent revolution as compared to the Piero Ignazi's silent counter-revolution. And I'll have my take on it. What Inglehart is saying is that there's like this Maslow hierarchy of needs. And at the top of the pyramid, after you've gotten fed and you've got shelter and you feel safe, as Maslow said, there's this self-actualization where you can dream about supranational institutions to solve world problems. And Inglehart says it's that group, the self-actualized, you'll trend towards the left. And if you're not in that state, you'll trend towards the right. And he established this concept immediately after the youthful revolutions in 1968, both in Europe and the United States. First, as a question about his work, which was done now almost 50 years ago, how is it as a predictive technique to establish whether or not you really will belong to the left or the right? Whether or not self-actualization is a good predictor of your political leanings?
Well, in some ways, I think it was very prescient. Inglehart was before his time, because the difference between left and right is no longer exclusively economic, about the distribution of resources within society, but is much more a question of people's cultural values. Values-based politics has become more important than distributional politics in terms of the distinctions between left and right and people's voting choices.
In the United States, if you were trying to predict a voter what party they belong to, the first question you might ask is, how educated are you? Number two is probably race. And then third might be income. And those aspects have gone under radical change since 1970. And for example, white, some college or high school education would have been a core to the Democratic Party. It's now core to the Republican Party. I wonder how these political science frameworks survive when there's such a substantial transition?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think if you look at European countries, we can see some similarities there. There's a really excellent book, if people want to understand European politics in that sense, called Diploma Democracy by two Dutch political scientists. And it says the same thing in some ways, as you said there, that education has become an increasingly important dividing line and driver of voting. And mixed up with that is now age. Certainly in the UK, for example, at the last election in 2019, the easiest way to tell how someone had voted was to ask their age. Minority ethnic populations will tend to vote left rather than right. I don't think we need to abandon necessarily all the voting models that we previously operated with, which tended to focus on, as you said, income and to a lesser extent, wealth and people's occupation. They still to some extent make a difference, but they don't make anywhere near as much difference as they used to, as the values, competence. How good a job that president or that prime minister is delivering public services does still matter to voters.
One hugely distinguishing feature of European politics is that each country has more than two major political parties. In Germany, you mentioned that on the left, that there were the Greens and the Social Democrats, and on the right, there was the CSU, CDU, as well as the AfD. In the UK, you've got Labour, Liberal Democrats, the Scottish National Party on the left, and Tories and UKIP on the right. What are the implications of coalition governance? And how does such a large number of political parties impact personal identity? I suspect that someone living in London might identify as a Brit, a Fulham football fan, and as a conservative, and they might also say self-identify as a European. So you have these various identities, and when there are five political parties, and it's very difficult to distinguish between where each individual party stands on various issues, how does that impact partisan identity?
Well, for one thing, it's actually declined over time. In most European countries now, the number of people who identify strongly with a particular party is really relatively low. And if you look at surveys done in the 1960s, it used to be a lot higher. And that makes a difference at elections. Most European countries, unlike the UK and unlike the US, have proportional representation, which in some ways gives people more choice. The trade-off is it makes for a much more complex governing situation. When it comes to coalition politics, in many countries, it works perfectly well. There doesn't actually seem to be that much of a link between countries' electoral systems, which sometimes, you know, produce actually very fragmented governments and good government in that country. And Germany is a very good example at the moment. They had an election a few weeks ago. It will probably take another month or so for them to get a government together. But the advantages in some ways of that process is that you get far more buy-in when that government finally takes shape. And you get a rather less polarized politics than you get under first past the post plurality systems as you have in the United Kingdom and the United States.
One example of the problems with a multi-party system is Italy since the Second World War. I mean, so many parties, no party ever wins an election, governments are coming and going. And moving away from Europe, the Israelis have a multi-party system. And just in the past 2 years, it took multiple elections to form a government. Why do you believe that a coalition government is more stable and better at governing? You know, from the U.S. perspective, once a president wins an election, he has 4 years to achieve his objectives and then go back to the people to seek re-election. Why do you think that the chaos that goes on regularly in Europe and with the strange results in Italy and Israel is superior?
Italy had its problems. But if you looked at Italy after the Second World War through to the 21st century, you actually see quite a lot of stability underneath the chaos because the Christian Democratic Party in Italy actually was always in government, albeit with different parties each time. Israel, I guess, is a particularly special case. They have got ethnic divides there and a very difficult external situation. And I think that is a special case. But if you look around the rest of Europe, I don't think you see anywhere near that chaos. Governments perhaps don't last quite as long as they do under the system in the United States, but they remain relatively stable. And as I say, the advantage is governments, believe it or not, are able to pass legislation without very much trouble. In some ways, these are contrasts with the United States, where the president is sometimes dependent on a legislature where he has no majority and therefore is actually unable to get some of the things he wants to get done through Congress.
In the recent past, the Scots predominantly voted for the Labour Party. But when the issue of Scottish independence came to the forefront, the Scottish National Party, or SNP, did extremely well in previous Labour enclaves. And my question is, when you get these single-issue parties like the SNP, how does that impact Labour success in MP elections? And if Labour loses Scotland permanently, does Labour have any chance of achieving a majority in the UK Parliament? And when you look at those specific MP races in Scotland, Labour sometimes finishes in third place. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, the UK isn't completely unusual in having a regionalist or a secessionist party within it. There are many countries in Europe that have these parties. So Scottish nationalism really first began to grow in the 1970s, and it really took off at the end of the 1990s and early 2000s when the Labour government in the UK opened a parliament in Scotland. It still sends lawmakers to the parliament in London, but it also has its own parliament. And this is where the SNP, once it won power in the Scottish parliament, it was able to persuade people that they should vote for the SNP in the elections to the London Westminster Parliament. as well, with the result that, as you quite rightly said, from being a kind of Labour fiefdom, Scotland is now very much a Scottish nationalist fiefdom. The Scottish Nationalist Party managed to extract a referendum on Scottish independence from the Conservative government in 2014. It lost that independence referendum, but actually it helped the party in its support, and it's won more seats at Westminster since then. So we are in a quite unstable situation in the UK. It could well be the case that we have a second Scottish referendum, in part because Scotland didn't vote to leave the European Union in the same way that other parts of the UK did, and the SNP have used that to their advantage. So we're really waiting to see what happens next.
Nationalism is our next topic. The nation state hasn't gone away. If anything, national pride, the use of language, culture, etc., it's still essential. How should we think about nationalism? Why does its importance fluctuate over time? The concept of the European is new and not rooted in the citizen's personal identity. I mean, there is no European football team or Olympic team. And most importantly, why does the issue of nationalism separate those on the left from those on the right?
Well, you're quite right to say that nationalism hasn't gone away. And I think one of the problems for the European Union has always been that it's really been unable to create a European demos or a European identity that trumps people's national identity. Having said that, if you look at surveys, a lot of people have these nested identities. They feel slightly more French than they do European. There isn't necessarily a zero-sum game. Poland is a very interesting case in point because the Poles are a very nationalistic society, and the presence of Putin's Russia exacerbates these kind of nationalist feelings. And yet if you do surveys of the Polish population, they are extremely positive about the European Union. Now, their government is not. Their government tries very hard to kind of whip up nationalist feeling against the European Union, but it hasn't been particularly successful in doing that. But that then, I think, raises the question of you're raising, really, which is where does nationalism come from? It isn't a kind of bottom-up phenomenon. It can be whipped up by entrepreneurial politicians for good or ill. And this is happening all the way across Europe. And it is something that right-wing politicians tend to do, because those who vote for the right tend to have rather more nationalistic feelings than those who vote for the left.
From the American perspective, Brexit seemed to be an incredibly important issue, and we've wondered, after its passage and its implementation, how does Brexit affect the relationship between the United Kingdom and the European Union? You know, there was so much gnashing of teeth with regard to trade and foreign policy. So what's happened so far, and what do you think will happen next?
Well, Brexit clearly is an incredibly important dividing line in the United Kingdom, and remains so. We've had what political scientists refer to as this sort of effective polarization since 2016. People have very strong leave identities and remain identities, and those leave and remain identities are actually stronger than identification with particular political parties. Although increasingly you found that those who voted leave and who see themselves as leavers tend to now vote conservative, which has been to Boris Johnson's advantage. I think it's important to stress that Brexit was always going to be a process rather than an event, that actually this is an ongoing negotiation. And unfortunately, relations between the European Union and the UK are still very difficult, in part because it suits the UK government under Boris Johnson to maintain that friction with the EU is quite a useful thing.
I want to turn to French politics next. I think what was absolutely shocking to me in the last French presidential election was the fact that Macron won despite not being a member of a major political party. That Macron's new political party, En Marche, in its first attempt, successfully won a presidential election. Another incredible event was that the major political parties in France did not even make it to the presidential runoff. I mean, this would be like in the United States, a situation where the Republicans and Democrats were unsuccessful in getting a candidate in the final round runoff. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So why in the last presidential election did Marine Le Pen and Macron make it to that runoff? And then you touched on this in your opening remarks, that a radio and TV host, Zemmour, is now one of the leading candidates in the next upcoming French presidential election. Now, recent polling has shown him to win between 15 and 20% of the votes in the first round, which is slightly more than hypothetical candidates from France's other major political parties.
Well, I think the framework of the silent counter-revolution is extremely important when you're looking at France and indeed other European countries, because you saw the rise of the far right, the Front National, under first Jean-Marie Le Pen and then his daughter, Marine Le Pen, really as a result of this backlash against immigration and against problems that France has with the integration of its ethnic minorities. And those were things that the centre-right party simply couldn't seem to cope with. And that meant that the Front National in some ways displaced the centre-right. But on the other hand, you had a very weak centre-left. And so there was a vacuum there, which Emmanuel Macron came in to fill. And really, as you say, was a phenomenon, someone who most French people hadn't really heard of, but just had a natural flair of politics and was able really to convince people that the old parties had failed and that unless they voted for him, then the alternative was an extreme that most French people really reject. Macron created his own party, En Marche, a few months just before the election, and not only won the presidential election, but then won the legislative elections, which gave himself a big majority in parliament.
Isn't that even more incredible than his own presidential race? I mean, in the United States, the concept that, you know, like Ross Perot, for example, as an independent, could win the presidency, but then that the Perot party could win a majority of the House is inconceivable. How is it possible that a institution with no on-the-ground apparatus could win a majority of the House? How is that possible?
Well, it is a phenomenon. Even in Europe, this is very, very unusual. I know we are in the age of the startup, but it is very, very unusual for a politician to be able to create a party from scratch and do so well. I think it is the case that that lack of loyalty has helped create a vacuum where talented entrepreneurial politicians can come in and surprise us all. But Macron is a phenomenon. It's important to say that the shine to some extent has gone off him. If you govern for a few years, eventually you don't look quite as shiny and new as you once did. But he still stands a very good chance of re-election next time around, particularly because he may be facing an extreme candidate that the majority of French people, whatever their feelings on immigration, will feel is just a little bit too extreme for them.
So do you think that that final round in the next presidential election in France will be between Macron and someone on the right, or is it possible it could be someone on the left?
I think it's very unlikely it'll be someone on the left. Very many left-wing voters in France will probably plump for Macron because they believe that he is the best of a bad bunch. And although he's a little bit neoliberal on the economy, they still see him as a liberal with a small L in social values. It looks to me once again as if the centre-right is actually quite fragmented, which will mean that the candidate that comes through will be from the far right. And at the moment, it looks as if it won't be the more traditional far-right party headed by Marine Le Pen, but it will be Éric Zemmour, who in some ways is a more frightening candidate than Marine Le Pen. If you care about progressive values, if you care about liberal democracy and you are worried by xenophobia, you worried by anti-immigration rhetoric, Zemmour is quite a frightening guy. But as a result of that, it will probably mean that if he does get into the second round and faces off against Macron, Macron will probably win fairly easily.
Our American audience doesn't know Zemmour, so maybe you could explain to us who he is, what he stands for, and why he's popular. I mean, he's not a politician. And what anger and frustration has he tapped into that has allowed him to become a leading candidate for the president of France? Now, where are the other career politicians from France's major political parties? And how can it be that these lifelong career politicians have little chance against a radio and TV personality who doesn't even belong to a political party and has never run for political office?
He has the very strong opinion that France's ethnic minorities don't do enough to integrate into French culture. He believes there is such a thing as French culture, and if they want to stay in France, then they ought to get with the program. And if they don't want to, then they should leave. Now, many French people do respond to that kind of rhetoric and those kinds of policies because the cultural change that they've seen over the last few decades is quite scary.
The working class communities in Northern England had been a core part of the Labour Party. The Tories just recently won what had been a Labour fiefdom for generations. And it reminds me of what happened in West Virginia. West Virginia had been predominantly Democratic since 1934, and in 2000, the state went for the Republicans, and it really hasn't looked back. I mean, Trump won that state by 40 points, and reflects the white working class, not college-educated, religious people who have become core voters in the Republican Party. And I seem to think that this is a very similar story what you're seeing in the north of England. Those voters who have been loyal to the Labour Party. To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, I didn't change my view. The Democratic Party left me. And Labour, they would argue, had left them. How do you think about the north of England and the fall of that election wall?
I think there are very strong parallels, actually, between what happened in the United States and what happened at the general election in the UK in 2019. You're absolutely right to say that in some ways, these people in the Midlands and in the north of England, in formerly Labour constituencies, had been voting Labour despite the fact that their values were actually quite different from the values espoused by the Labour Party. They were far more nationalistic, they would say patriotic, far more worried about immigration, far less comfortable with some of the social changes that the Labour government under Tony Blair had made than those Labour Party lawmakers representing them. Brexit broke the relationship between those voters and the Labour Party. I think the question is, and it's interesting that you talk about how West Virginia has gradually become more Republican over time, is whether that will actually happen in those seats in the so-called Red Wall. It may well be that their relationship with the Conservative Party is rather more transactional than that. And it may well be that the Labour Party is able to moderate its social liberalism in order to appeal to them on economic grounds and not put them off, if you like, voting Labour on values questions.
I'm actually surprised, Tim. I think there's a bet in the offing. I would think that Northern and Middle England is more like West Virginia. I think if I interview a generation from now, my expectation is that it will be conservative by 40.
Well, right. Let's go back to the conversation we had about Scotland there, because, of course, that's what happened in Scotland. Once the dam broke, there was no way back for Labour. And it could be that that is exactly what happens in the Midlands and the North. The Conservatives are vulnerable in other places. As the Conservatives become more like a populist radical right party, then some of their voters in the leafy suburbs of larger cities.
The self-actualized.
Yeah, absolutely. Self-actualized voters begin to think, well, we may as well give Labour a go. The problem for the Labour Party, however, is that those voters tend to be concentrated in urban areas. And the way that the electorates, the districts are carved up in the UK means that the Conservatives vote among these socially conservative people, among Leave voting people, is much more efficiently spread, so that Labour will pile up lots of liberal self-actualized voters in cities and just outside cities, but it won't do them very much good, because in the end, the Leave vote, the socially conservative vote, is rather more spread across the country and therefore delivers more MPs for the Conservative Party in Parliament.
Let's go back to France. We've talked about the West Virginia voter as compared to those in the north of England. But what about comparing the West Virginia voter to similar ones in France? Now, I'm thinking about those protesters who live just outside of Paris and are referred to as the Yellow Jackets. This group appears not to be politically represented by anybody. And these Yellow Jackets are angry because they think that the Macron government and the Parisian elites don't understand them, don't care about them, and actually even may wish them harm. Now, these Yellow Jackets hit the streets and rioted during the first year of Macron's government, but they haven't disappeared.
Well, you're right, the high-vis jacket guys. They're clearly still around. They haven't caused as many problems as they did in the early years of the Macron presidency, partly because he's actually adjusted policy in order to make things a little bit easier for them in terms of their daily lives. They began by protesting about fuel prices in less urban areas, and he's been rather more careful on those grounds. I mean, if they do come out to vote, I don't see them as a voting bloc necessarily, but in as much as they will vote. Well, they might well vote for the far right, whether it be for Zemmour, because these politicians, both Marine Le Pen and Zemmour, they don't just get votes on immigration. They do get votes on this very populist idea that they represent the people in deepest France against the Parisian establishment that Macron does represent. I don't see that most French people will go for that extreme an alternative. I think faced with the choice between a centrist politician like Macron and a more extreme politician, in the end, in the runoff, they'll go for Macron.
In your book, Riding the Populist Wave, one of the subjects is the role of the Christian right and the importance of religion in European politics has declined over time, I suspect because of a decline in religiosity in Europe. And maybe that we're combining a couple of different ideas. When we talk about nationalism and values, religiosity is a component of that, just as it is in the United States. I think if we go back to West Virginia, I think there is a substantial religious component to those values. How should we think about the role of religion in the choice of partisanship in terms of values and how that fits in with center-right parties?
The biggest difference, I would say, between US politics and European politics is the question of religion. It does still play some residual part in European politics, and in particular, identification with that branch of the center-right that calls itself Christian Democratic. It's still the case that people who go to church are rather more likely, if there's a Christian Democratic alternative on offer, to vote for Christian Democratic parties than they are for parties on the center-left or indeed other conservative parties. The levels of religious observance in Europe right across the continent are far, far lower than they are in the United States. It really is a minority sport, church going. There's still quite a lot of believing. There's just not very much belonging in Europe. And even when you look at religiously motivated voters, they tend to vote for Christian Democratic parties rather than radical right. Religious voters in Europe tend to be rather more sympathetic to immigration than are non-religious voters, partly because they have this tradition of charity, of welcoming strangers as friends.
Why are there no European parties?
Well, quite frankly, the European Parliament just is not that important either in terms of policymaking in individual countries or in terms of how people think about politics on the ground. Voters obviously do vote for the European Parliament every 5 years, but turnout is incredibly low, and most people see it as very much a kind of second order affair. They don't really have any very strong links with their representatives in the European Parliament. They really don't think about them and probably can't even name most of them, to be honest.
Do you think this is the function of the design of the European Constitution? One is that legislation itself is derived and created by the bureaucracy. I mean, it is a bit shocking as an American that legislation is written by an unelected body of bureaucrats. And then the second aspect is that there's this requirement of unanimity among the European nations for major decision making, which limits their ability to get things done without negotiations between the nation states, bringing them back into the power dynamic. And then on the foreign policy side, the inability to use any military force without the permission of leaders of the respective nation states. Do you think that the European Union is like the Articles of Confederation back in the 18th century United States, that was a limited supranational institution that lacked power to do anything material?
Yeah, there's no doubt that if ever there is a conflict between those two, then it's intergovernmentalism. It's the nation states that win out. It's never going to be that powerful because member states don't want it to be that powerful.
In the American newspapers last weekend, they showed some photographs of immigrants from Belarus trying to get into Poland. And the headline was something like, "Belarus weaponizes migrants." Now, immigration has been a critical issue. How did it affect European elections because these migrants caused some law and order issues? It influenced Brexit. The French were very concerned about it. It's not going away, and fears of immigration will remain a simmer, and it's the top story in Europe right now. Tell me about how immigration impacts European politics.
If you look at European politics over the last 20 years, you'd have to say that if there's one phenomenon that has made the biggest difference, it is migration. It clearly is a concern to a very large section of European electorates. There are lots of politicians who are very keen on exploiting their fears and indeed, of course, responding to their fears. I don't want to say that those fears are necessarily somehow illegitimate. It's been, I think, even more pronounced since 2015, when we had this European migrant crisis where we had large numbers of people fleeing Syria. And we had a situation in which Angela Merkel, very, very bravely in some ways, and some people obviously disagreed with what she did, eventually allowed very, very large numbers of people to come in to Germany. On the question of Belarus and Poland, it's a fascinating one, that, because in some ways it's a win-win, although it doesn't sound like it. Poland, which is essentially a kind of populist radical right government, has been scaring the population of Poland with stories about immigration for years. And in some ways, what's happening on their border, although they profess not to like it and it is a problem for them, in some ways plays into that narrative, paradoxically. On the other side of the border, we have Alexander Lukashenko from Belarus, who is clearly using these people to try and get Europe to negotiate away the sanctions that they have imposed on him as a result of him once again stealing an election. I think most Europeans are rather more worried about the immigration coming from sub-Saharan Africa, as well as the Middle East, and coming into Europe via Africa, sometimes in small boats, into Greece, into Italy, and into, to some extent, Spain. And every country in Europe is worried about it.
Some believe that the survival of the European Union depends on the willingness of the North to continue to make substantial transfer payments to the South. Now, during COVID, redistribution issues subsided, likely because of the general lack of concern about spending during a crisis. But I suspect it's just a matter of time before redistribution once again takes center stage, especially if there's some sort of a financial crisis, and the Germans will again question how much money they're giving the Italians, the Spanish, and the Portuguese. Do you think that this is an issue? It's like a time bomb waiting to explode?
One of the difficulties of the European Union has been creating a public that feels totally European, and that, I think, does present an obstacle to anyone who wants to undertake a serious redistribution of resources from the wealthier North to the poorer South and the wealthier West to the poorer East. I think those big fiscal transfers are always going to be a problem. And in some ways, that is one of the limitations, I think, on the European Union becoming a full federation. I just don't think that can happen while we don't have the levels of European identity and solidarity among ordinary people that would be required.
I end each episode on a note of optimism. Tim, what are you optimistic about?
Well, I mean, I actually think that given some of the problems that COVID has caused, that European economies do seem to be bouncing back. They don't seem to be suffering from the unemployment that many people suspected might be the case. The fiscal pump priming that governments undertook during the extremes of the pandemic do seem to have paid off. I think although we worry and we fret, particularly about immigration in many countries in Europe, actually we're pretty good at integrating ethnic minorities without too many strains and too many problems.